WBUR.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point in Britain. 2.5 million closed-circuit cameras watch everyone's every move. In Singapore, a nationwide vehicle tracking system tracks every vehicle, every mile. In Israel, don't be surprised by a 40-minute interrogation before boarding an airplane. Different countries, different techniques, all used to fight terrorism. But what if all of those techniques and much more were used in one place, right here at home in America? This hour on Point, the homeland security state fortress America and its cost to freedom. But first, a blunt reminder of the nuclear crisis on the Korean Peninsula. On Monday, North Korea fired a short-range missile into the Sea of Japan as U.S. and regional leaders were gathering in Seoul for today's inauguration of South Korea's new president, No Moo-hyun. Bradley Graham covers the Pentagon for The Washington Post. I asked him to explain, or to give North Korea's explanation for the missile launch.
The North Koreans have acknowledged testing an anti-ship cruise missile yesterday. It was really no surprise to U.S. analysts and others who had been watching this launch in preparation. And in fact, the North Koreans had announced a navigational restriction in the Sea of Japan ahead of the launch, which is a dead giveaway that something was about to happen. Mm-hmm. The missile itself is a short-range missile. It's got a special designation, the KN-01. And U.S. intelligence analysts say this is a weapon that's been in development for several years, and there have been about a dozen test launches of this solid rocket booster since late 2000.
So, Bradley Graham, were it not for the nuclear crisis going on in the Korean Peninsula, would this be considered a normal part of military training, military exercises?
It wouldn't have attracted much attention. The previous 11 or 12 test launches didn't warrant any notice, but you're absolutely right. Because of the current tensions over North Koreans' pursuit of nuclear weapons, because of Secretary Powell's visit to the Korean Peninsula yesterday, this launch caused quite a stir.
But it was not the kind of provocation that North Korea launched with its missile that overflew Japan some time ago.
Well, it was nowhere near as threatening as the Taipodong 1 launch in August 1998. That was a test of a medium to long-range missile that the North Koreans have been pursuing. It's a particular concern in the United States because of its potential in subsequent iterations to reach at least Alaska and Hawaii and possibly the continental United States. In fact, that launch in 98 helped spur renewed interest in national missile defense in this country.
Bradley Graham, let me ask you just a technical question. I heard this missile described as conventional, not ballistic. What's the distinction?
Well, it's a cruise missile, not a ballistic missile. You know, a ballistic missile gets shot into the air and follows a kind of an arc and is brought back down to Earth through gravitational pull. It doesn't steer itself, whereas a cruise missile can steer itself in various ways. Ballistic missiles tend to have very long range. They tend to be able to span oceans. Cruise missiles tend to be much, much shorter in range. But some of the more very sophisticated kinds, like that the U.S. has tended to use in striking Iraq and other adversaries in recent years, can hit very precisely and have all kinds of terrain-following features and so on.
Whatever the technology of North Korea's missile, the timing was incredibly provocative, coming just on the as South Korea prepared to inaugurate its new president. How have South Korea, the U.S., Japan responded?
Officially, everybody has tried to play down the significance of the launch, saying that, stressing it was just a short-range missile, and one that the North Koreans had tested periodically and repeatedly in recent years, and one that had been known to be coming. But clearly, it's being taken as a signal, a political signal of North Korea's intention still to stand firm by its determination to show it will defend itself.
We've been repeatedly told on this show, Bradley, that North Korea is determined to bring the nuclear crisis to a head at the same time that the United States is tangled up with Iraq. Are you hearing in Washington or from the Far East expectation or fear of more military action, military gestures, as the U.S. steps into engagement with Iraq?
Well, it's definitely a chief concern in the administration as it gets ready to possibly invade Iraq, there is little certainty about just what the North Koreans' ultimate intentions are, whether they're pursuing nuclear weapons now with renewed vigor because they actually want to become a more significant nuclear power, or whether they simply intend to use these weapons or the threat of development of more of these weapons as bargaining chips to win economic assistance and other concessions from the United States.
As they push the line, what's the state of U.S. forces in the area? There were some high-profile additions to forces a few weeks ago. Are they continuing to supplement forces there?
Some bombers were put on alert in the continental United States to send to the island of Guam. Those remain on alert. They haven't yet been deployed. Some additional reconnaissance aircraft have been sent to the region to provide some extra eyes and ears on what the North Koreans may be up to, and some fighter aircraft that were already in the Pacific region may have been already repositioned or in the process of being repositioned just to reduce the potential response times. In addition, the aircraft carrier that is normally based in Japan, the Kitty Hawk, has been ordered to the Persian Gulf for possible Iraq duty, and so the Pentagon is sending a replacement carrier to be in the waters off of the Korean Peninsula. But the Pentagon has said that there is no intention of adding additional ground forces to the Korean Peninsula, where there are now 37,000 or so U.S. troops stationed. There's been no indication of any further supplementing of U.S. forces, at least for the time being.
So Washington tries to keep it cool while North Korea ups the ante. Bradley Graham, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bradley Graham covers the Pentagon for The Washington Post. He spoke with me earlier from Washington. The Department of Homeland Security recently raised the terror alert to high. The alert was a reminder that the war on terror is far from over and that American life is changing in profound ways. It's more than just duct tape, taking off your shoes at the airport, and maybe one day a smallpox vaccination. Decisions have to be made about how much freedom we're willing to trade for security, about how much in dollars and liberty we're willing to pay to lock down America. A real maximum security state means metal detectors at the mall, a camera on every corner, and Americans incarcerated on the basis of rumor. It means changing the fundamental character of American life with no guarantee that terrorism won't succeed anyway. Is this the kind of America you want to live in? How much freedom are you willing to give up for security? Or will we be risking another terrorist attack if we don't do everything to strengthen Fortress America? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Matthew Brzezinski, contributing editor to the New York Times Magazine. His article, The Homeland Security State, How Far Should We Go?, appeared in Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Good evening and welcome, Matthew Brzezinski.
Thank you. Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. I want to compliment you on a terrific piece Sunday, very provocative, putting the issues out there in I think, just the way that we ought to be considering them and giving us a sense of the gravity of the kind of changes that are underway around us right now as we speak that will reshape this country's politics and this country's physical daily life in the years ahead. Matthew Brzezinski, I want to get into the details, the kind of layers of security you see as potentially coming to the United States if we embrace the full Fortress America. But before we do that, lay out for us, if you would, the kind of big, big questions here. What are the stakes? What are the issues that Americans should be considering as we weigh security measures?
I think there's one central issue. It's how secure do you feel? How safe do you feel? Do you worry that something can happen while your children are taking the bus to school, while they're on the subway? And I think that ultimately it is how each American individually feels that will dictate what eventually we do or do not tolerate. At the moment, I think that people are very anxious. However, we are not frightened enough that we will accept some of the measures that are being contemplated. For instance, Congress several weeks ago said that a new program launched by the Pentagon called the Total Information Awareness Program, mm-hmm. which was intended to essentially sift through every aspect of our electronic life, every website we visit, every credit card bill we have, every phone bill we have, our medical mm-hmm. records. It could basically know every single thing that we do, and huge computers would sift through this information and theoretically try to look for hidden patterns that might tip off some sort of terrorist activity.
And that, after Congress looked at it, we're not going to do quite to the full extent for now.
Exactly. And Congress said that, well, maybe the dangers of something like this at this point outweigh the benefits, the potential benefits.
Matthew Brzezinski, I want to do something that's maybe too much chutzpah. You wrote the article, but I must say the central issue that your piece raised in my mind was a little different, and in part teeing off of what you wrote there yourself, which is not so much that it's a question of how we feel, whether we feel secure, because as you pointed out, feelings are almost infinitely manipulable. But mm-hmm. but this maybe even larger or at least twin question of how much in terms of material wealth and in terms of personal liberty and freedoms and quality of life as we known it, we're prepared to offer up in the name of security, and whether it will buy security if and when we should even do that.
Well, that's part of that mm-hmm. main issue that, for instance, if you and I are speaking a year from now, there has been no major terrorist incident in the United States, we'll say, well, you know what? We went too far, even with what we've implemented so far. Mm-hmm. And it's time to roll back. However, if you and I are talking again in the foreseeable future, and there's been a terrible, terrible catastrophe, and there's 30,000 dead mm-hmm. because of some biological or chemical attack in a major American city, we'll be saying, my God, we haven't gone anywhere nearly far enough. And we will likely, willingly relinquish some of our freedoms of movement. We will put up with more inconvenience. We will devote greater resources. And I mean, I think you see this in nations where they really think their survival is at stake, such as Israel. They devote an extraordinary amount of resources to security, as everybody knows, and they put up with an incredible amount of inconvenience. And the odd thing is that they get used to it. And when they come here and they don't have the layers upon layers of security, they actually feel very vulnerable and exposed. That's their initial instinct.
You wrote yourself about having lived in Moscow and gotten accustomed to seeing police and soldiers with big rifles on the street and feeling odd when you came back to the States and didn't see that.
Yeah, it's amazing how people get used to things. You and I are too young for this, but from what I've read and heard from my grandparents, during World War II, during the Blitz in London, bombs were falling, and yet people were living more or less normal lives.
We're going to come back and look at details, but how much could American life change if we put the pedal to the metal for full security?
Oh, completely. Mundane tasks, going to get a hamburger, would involve going through security. Going to the movies would involve security. Everywhere there would be surveillance technology and software with face recognition programs.
And the mindset of Americans, the personality, the political character of Americans?
It would have to change. It would redefine our notions of freedom and liberty. And this would have to happen only gradually we would grudgingly give up these things. For now, it's difficult even to imagine any of this. But I think that many, 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 many years ago it would have been impossible for people to imagine that in the 1950s, for instance, that our school children would have to go through security and metal detectors and be searched for guns while going to high school.
Matthew Brzezinski, we have to take a short break. Stand by, please. We're talking tonight about homeland security, the maximum security state, and how far we really want to go. Do you want to live in full fortress America? Are you prepared to be tracked, poked, prodded, undressed, spied on, and locked up on a whim in the hope of more security? On the other hand, is it irresponsible not to lock down America? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about homeland security, about the maximum security state, and how far we really want to go in the United States. My guest is Matthew Brzezinski. He's contributing editor at the New York Times Magazine, author of a great article in the magazine last Sunday, The Homeland Security State, How Far Should We Go? Do you want to live in full fortress America? What if we spend trillions more on security and it still doesn't work? Would you rather be safe than sorry or run some risks in the name of freedom? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Cindy's calling from Foxborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Cindy. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
My comment is I lost my husband on September 11th in the World Trade Center. Mm-hmm. And for me, my family has changed forever. I have a different opinion today than I did on September 10th. I'm willing to do whatever it takes to keep people safe. I will go through extra security. I will gladly take my shoes off. I will gladly empty my purse. I will gladly go through an interrogation if that will save lives. And I'm willing to live in that extra security, even being screened at a movie theater, to know that my children are safe. Our lives are changed forever because we took it so for granted that we were just safe and went about our business and thought nothing of running on an airplane and not going through any security at all.
Cindy, is this Cindy McGinty, whose husband was a pilot?
My husband worked in the for Marsh McLennan, and he was at the World Trade Center for a meeting that day.
Oh, I see. All right. And you're saying you would give up whatever it took. You've paid an enormous price.
I have. You know, my family has changed forever.
So, but put it. You remain an American. You know the kind of political tradition you were raised to believe in. Do you think, Cindy, that we can have it both security and the great American legacy of freedom as we've understood it?
I think it has to change, sadly. I think that I would give you a different answer than I would have on September 10th. I think that we do have to give up some of our rights to be safe. I think that if you go through the airport in Israel, it's nothing to stand there and be interrogated for 30 minutes mm-hmm. as a business person traveling. But you know what? They don't get hijackers out of there.
Mm-hmm. Cindy,
to me, it's worth it.
We've got it. The calculation has been made terribly, terribly plain in your family's case, and we thank you for calling tonight, Cindy.
Thanks.
Matthew Brzezinski,
this is something that
may be the baseline case right there. I mean, here's an American mm-hmm. woman whose family lost a husband and father on September 11th. She's willing to do whatever it takes.
This is the point that I was raising, that right now we can't make these decisions because we haven't been faced with the sort of terrible, terrible, terrible tragedy that Cindy has. And that if something happens again, if there is another 9/11, or if there's a series of 9/11s, then we will all start thinking like that. And this has happened in other countries.
Matthew Brzezinski, take us through some of the kind of detail. If we start layering on everything that we could lay on in terms of security, what would some of that look like? Paint a picture for us of full fortress America.
Oh, boy, that's a long, long list.
Click through it.
Let's, start with industry. Industry would have to be complete. Everything would have to be revamped. A lot of our industry is in densely populated areas. That's a no-no. That's a risk.
Move it out, have big buffer zones around vulnerable factories.
Absolutely. And there is our industry is virtually unprotected. And when you go to Israel, or even parts of Europe or Asia, and you see an oil refinery or a terminal such as the one that exploded in Staten Island mm-hmm. on Friday, these things look like military installations with all the huge fences and sensors and guards. And in the United States, you can almost walk into any of them, and that's just asking for trouble.
So massive investments there. What about in a personal life, in a individual citizen's life? How might it change?
I think we'd have to put up with a lot more inconvenience, basically, hassles. Lineups to park our car because they have to search the trunk for weapons.
This is at the shopping mall.
This is going to your office building or the shopping mall or whatnot. We'd have to be prepared that when we're We may be being videotaped and watched, but I think we are already on camera so often, and except the cameras belong to the private sector.
But you describe it as the national ID card. When we swipe on the subway, there's an acknowledgement that we're there. Our backyard may be observed at any time of day or even night, I suppose, by aerial photography.
It's like the technology is moving at a just lightning pace. And national ID cards are something that certainly I think are going to be coming in the future. And the technology that exists means that these are smart cards, which come embedded with microchips where you can store all sorts of financial, personal, medical information, where they can keep an algorithm of your thumbprint, and police can have portable scanners that you then can make sure that you are who your ID says you are.
Facial recognition that could be snatched up anywhere, anytime, tracking embedded in the roads that would follow our vehicles wherever they were. And you write about a different attitude toward arresting and imprisoning people, even throwing people in the slammer with no alert to the family, kind of just disappearing.
This is something that David Cole, one of your upcoming guests, will probably be able to address even better because it's his specialty. But there's a proposed bill right now which would allow secret arrests, would even allow Americans to have their citizenship stripped if they were suspected of belonging to a terrorist organization.
Citizenship stripped on the basis of a suspicion.
As this is the proposed bill, yes.
This is from the Justice Department.
Yes, this is yes from the
kind of extension of the Patriot Act.
Yes, this is the Homeland Security Enhancement Act of 2003, if memory serves me correctly.
So we're talking absolutely radical here.
Well, we're as the Attorney General said, you know, extraordinary times call for extraordinary measures, and I certainly don't agree with everything that he is doing, but he will give you his reasoning for secret arrests or for not disclosing the names of many of the young Muslim immigrants who were rounded up after 9/11, and he'll say, "Well, listen, in the war on terror, you have to use different tactics than in criminal investigations, which is what we've been accustomed to here in the United States. And if you release people's names, well, perhaps their controllers or their minders." In the terrorist central, so to speak, will get wind of this and will know that they may have to abort an operation or take measures to replace that their sleeper agent. Whereas if they simply disappear, well, then the terrorist masterminds don't know what happened to them, and are at a loss, and this may disrupt the entire network.
But simply disappear is a phrase that we've never been too fond of in this country. You're right. We could have the highest degree of public safety the world has ever seen, but what would the country look like, and what will it be like to live in it? David Cole is joining us from Washington. He's professor of law at Georgetown University and author of Terrorism in the Constitution, Sacrificing Civil Liberties in the Name of National Security. Good evening and welcome, David Cole.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. David, I'm sure you read Matthew Brzezinski's piece in the Times on Sunday. You've heard him this evening again describing the kind of maximum security state that we could become. How far onto that road do you see the United States now? How much further could we go? And broadly, how would you characterize the cost in dollars and freedoms that might entail?
Well, I think Matthew is absolutely right that we're headed in that direction, and technology is pushing in that direction. And it's interesting see technology as being the real threat here in terms of the broader availability of weapons of mass destruction, easier for small groups of people to do really catastrophic damage. We're also looking to technology as the solution, some sort of all-pervading eye that will be able to see all, know all, and prevent all. And I guess one sense I have is that there's always a balance to be struck. A police state in which the police could regularly search everybody's home would be a place in which there would be less crime. But it's not a place that we would want to live in. And so there is always a balance to be struck. The second point I'd make is that there's an illusion here, I think, which is that technology can, in fact, solve the problem, that we can, in fact, have something like total security. And that's just wholly unrealistic. Take Israel, which, you know, Matthew describes in the article as a place that has adopted many of the more extreme measures, ones that we would not accept, and yet it has been the subject of more violence, far more violence per capita than we have. So I don't think we can police our way out of this problem. I don't think we can solve it technologically, and I do think there's real risks here, which we are unfortunately forgetting, which is that the government, with this kind of information, has the power and often the motivation to misuse it to target people who are merely dissenters, who merely disagree with the status quo or with the policy of the current administration.
David Cole, I wonder, do you see us still in the kind of naive early aftermath of 9/11? Are the stakes as high as that? Can you imagine an America 10 years, 20 years hence that we would not recognize in terms of levels of security and what's been sacrificed in freedom and privacy at that point?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it much depends on what happens over the next, you know, decade in terms of future attacks and what kinds of threats we're really faced with, because I do think that, you know, we've now gone a year and a half or so without another terrorist attack, and I think that polls show increasing concern about civil liberties, increasing concern about government overreaching. We've seen Congress block the Total Information Awareness Program, which was one of the most sort of sweeping uses of technology to try to do data mining on everybody's private and publicly accessible computer data. That was blocked. We saw the Operation TIPS program that the Justice Department had put in place blocked by Congress. We even saw national ID cards blocked by Congress. So I do think
So far, I
think that there is now at least growing concern about going too far and about striking a balance. And of course the difficulty is in the immediate aftermath of any catastrophic event, all balance goes out the window, and people give the government tremendous amounts of power, and that power, it's not easy to take that power back.
But Matthew Brzezinski, you write that can change. Obviously, it can change with new events. You also write that the government itself has power to influence the feelings, the level of security that people feel in the absence of an attack. And then you quote a Shin Bet veteran from the Israeli intelligence service saying, as long as you worry too much about making false arrests and don't start taking greater risks, you are never going to beat terrorism. So there's always that whisper in the ear saying, if you don't drop some of these liberties, you are at risk.
Don't you think it's a little bit crazy to be taking advice from the Shin Bet about beating terrorism? I mean, they have not beat terrorism. They face, you know, suicide bombings almost weekly, and so I don't think that going the route that Israel has gone is going to make us safer.
Matthew Brzezinski, do you see the political will or temptation, though, to go that way, willy-nilly?
I certainly see the temptation, particularly from some people in the current administration. There's no question about that. And I do think that a lot of criticism leveled at the FBI, saying that both for structural and cultural reasons, they are really an ineffective force in the war on terror domestically, are justified, and that we are going to have to, you know, revamp our intelligence network here in the United States. So, you know, there are valid points on both sides, and this is what, you know, what makes this whole discussion so interesting is there is no right, no wrong.
But what about David Cole's point? What about David Cole's point? And you make it a bit yourself that we could do everything. We could go to the max. We could ape Israel as the garrison state, and thereby lose all these freedoms, lose the character of American life, and still be vulnerable to terrorism.
Well, you know, also Israel still. If Israel wasn't a garrison state, Israel wouldn't exist. And this is a point we shouldn't forget. The Israelis also live amongst their enemy. The United States, it's a lot more difficult to strike at the United States in certain respects, particularly now with, you know, very tight controls on who comes into the country than it is in Israel, where you know, you hop a small fence and you're right there. And the fact that terrorists have had to resort to suicide bombers because nothing else has been effective is a point that shows that, you know, that in fact, and even with suicide bombers, the Shin Bet does stop 90% of terrorist attempts.
But still not very consoling when you see the level of death there. And when you look at 9/11 here, Matthew Brzezinski, David Cole, please stand by. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. Chris is calling from Boston. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello. It's ironic that one's listening to National Public Radio and hearing a conversation that could be on what I call black helicopter radio. It sounds to me as if there's a fair amount of scaremongering going on here. Having done a fair amount of travel at the height of the security problems in Northern Ireland, having been to Israel in the Intifada, the first Intifada in the late 80s, I'm aware of the necessity of protecting citizens. And when one discusses that and then sort of leaps to the, you know, wholesale loss of American freedom, it seems to me something's missing there. And that is that there is a need of the government, and this is why we have a government, to protect citizens. And I wonder whether or not, in fact, you know, we can all spin scenarios that almost end up sounding like some kind of Hollywood plot line where the government takes over and is planting chips in everyone's heads. But those are the people in the shelters downtown. On National Public Radio, I wonder if we can have a discussion about what is necessary in order to protect citizens and what people need to accept as reality. In Belfast,
we don't know what is necessary. We don't have any experience with terrorism.
How
do we know? We don't know
Belfast,
yet.
In Belfast, they have experience. In Jerusalem, they have experience.
Chris, hang on, and let's pick this straight up. David Cole, let me put it to you. Is it black helicopter radio to discuss losses of liberty that may be attendant to security measures?
No, of course it isn't. I mean, we've already seen significant losses of liberty. They have, for the most part, not been suffered by American citizens. They've, for the most part, been suffered by foreign nationals here because it's, of course, much easier for the polity to say we're going to give up their liberty, the liberty of foreign nationals, particularly Arab and Muslim foreign nationals, for our security. And so we've adopted laws that would give the Attorney General the power to certify that someone is a suspected terrorist and then lock them up without a hearing, to deport people for wholly innocent associations with groups that we don't like, to deny people entry to the country based on what they say, not what they do, to we locked up in the immediate aftermath of September 11th, 1,200 people in 7 weeks, three of whom were ultimately charged with anything related to terrorism, not convicted, charged. The rest of them, virtually all of them, affirmatively cleared by the FBI.
David Cole, I know we have to lose you. We're coming up on a break. I want to thank our caller, Chris. And David Cole, thank you for joining us. David Cole is professor of law at Georgetown University and author of Terrorism and the Constitution, Sacrificing Civil Liberties in the Name of National Security. We're talking about Homeland Security Night, the maximum security state, and how far we really want to go. Would you rather be safe than sorry or run some risks in the name of freedom? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about homeland security and the maximum security state, how far we really want to go. Is the homeland security state a country you want to live in? Are you eager to live in it? Are you resigned to it? How much security is just right? How much is too much? Metal detectors at the mall? The government in your email? Cameras on every corner? Is it irresponsible not to lock down America? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is Matthew Brzezinski, author of the article in Sunday's New York Times Magazine, The Homeland Security State, How Far Should We Go? Matthew Brzezinski, we had our caller Chris saying, come on, guys, settle down. This is fear-mongering. Is that what you presented Sunday? Is that what this conversation amounts to, or is there a real, credible, important conversation about where we draw lines?
When I set out to write the article, I actually initially set out to write an article about how prepared are we to defend ourselves against terrorism, and I started looking at vulnerabilities and asking questions of going out on the front lines and talking to police officers and people from the FBI and sort of saying, well, okay, this is a target, but how do you defend this target? And I wasn't getting any answers. And they would say, well, you know, I don't know, or it can't be done. Hmm. And this is why I ended up looking at the case of places like Israel, because it turned out that they had all the answers. And then I started thinking that, well, you know what, maybe the threat of counter-terror measures is actually more frightening than the threat of terrorism itself. And this is how the whole thing morphed into Fortress America. How far do we go, and is this too far?
But our caller says, look at Belfast, look at Israel, life goes on. It's not great. No one would wish for it, but it's bearable.
It is bearable, but in a sense, it's as if we may tell our grandchildren that, well, you know, we grew up in an age of innocence before any of this happened, and that this was just part, this is global, truly globalization. We've now joined the rest of the world. Is it fear mongering? Is it what's important is to have these sorts of discussions. People don't know anything about Homeland Security. The government knows precious little about Homeland Security. Our learning curve in this country is extraordinarily steep. And I think the more information that we have, the more options that we look at, the more scenarios, be they Hollywood or not, that we examine, the better informed we will be to make decisions when that time comes.
And I guess the thing I came away from your piece with, Matthew, that really stuck in my mind was, what if we take all these measures, with all the surrendering of liberties that implies, and we remain, as you say, vulnerable to terrorism? What if we give all that up and we're still not secure? Greg's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
How are you tonight?
Great, thanks.
Good. My question is, are we really just taking the wrong approach here? And what I mean by that is our security not in the United States, but is it overseas? In other words, shouldn't we be doing more to prevent people from wanting to do these things to us? If you look back as examples, desperate people do desperate things, and the United States Navy suffered more casualties at the end of the Second World War when the Japanese launched waves of kamikazes in a desperate attempt to suicide bomb our planes. And the same thing happens over at Israel, because they have a very bad situation over there between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And I look at all the money and all the effort and things that go forth into trying to protect us here, but really, shouldn't we be trying to motivate people not to commit terrorist acts by changing our policies overseas?
Matthew Brzezinski.
It would mean completely withdrawing from the Middle East. It would mean essentially abandoning Israel, both of which I just don't see happening in the near future. But the caller is absolutely right that my greatest fear, for instance, with any potential war in Iraq, is not that, how long the war will take or what it will cost, but what are the domestic implications? That by having foreign adventurers, are we creating legions of enemies? And Saddam Hussein, I think, knows very well that if he lifts a finger against the United States, that he is in very, very serious trouble, and that's the end of his tenure as the leader of Iraq. But if he knows we're coming to get him anyways, and we make announcements, March 7th, I think, is the latest, where we're basically telling him, well, we're coming on this day, well, he has nothing to lose. And then I think he will want to go down in sort of a blaze of glory, and he certainly at his disposal has weapons of mass destruction. He has an international network of embassies, consulates. So he has the means and ways of delivering some sort of terrorist-type weapon and striking us here at home.
Matthew, let me put this back to Greg. Your assertion that it would require abandoning the Middle East and abandoning Israel. Greg, do you agree?
I don't agree with that because, we've lived since 1948 with Israel, and we haven't had huge numbers of terrorist attacks occurring in the United States in the, in the last 50 years. Obviously, up till 9/11, most of us thought we were pretty secure from that. And people have to be motivated to do these horrible things. And I think we have to take a look at how our relations are with these countries and what our policies are, because those are the drivers, those are the things that will ultimately make us safe here, not checking our shoes at the airport.
And Matthew Brzezinski,
the caller is absolutely right. Yes.
And also, you point out that the cost of the kind of fortress America would be absolutely colossal. Taking Greg's perspective, if we took that money instead and invested it in development abroad, instead of retreating, but actively pushing out into the world in a positive way, might that not create a different situation outside the United States, so we don't have to surrender what being American means inside the United States?
Well, I mean, the two factors that one hears over and over and over again from terrorists justifying, you know, attacking in the United States is the presence of U.S. soldiers in Saudi Arabia, in the Holy Land, and sort of a myopic view and blind support of Israel. We would have to, that's what I mean by withdraw, we couldn't meddle, basically. No matter what we did, if we gave money, we would have to give money through a government. That government may be repressing its own people. And then the people who are repressed are naturally radicalized, and they see their leaders as just puppets of the West or the United States, and it backfires. It's so complicated. I spent a great many years in the former Soviet Union, and I saw, you know, tens and hundreds of billions of dollars being thrown at Russia, much of it ending up in you know, Swiss bank accounts. And I'm following the 98 crash, Americans and America was so unpopular in Russia, and, you know, as much so as for supporting Yeltsin blindly, for supporting these capitalism, which to the ordinary Russians just meant, you know, absolute poverty and gangsterism. And America spent all this money, and it didn't gain any friends. It came, you know, it had to retreat, and ordinary Russians you know, held it against Americans. And I think we risk the same thing happening in the Middle East.
Greg, thanks for your call. I want to get one more. Frank's calling from Boston. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Hi, Matthew. My comment is that I feel that Americans really don't want to live in a repressive atmosphere. We're willing to put up with risks. We have since Russia had the nuclear bomb. I mean, we've had a peace for about maybe 10 years or so where we didn't feel threatened by, quote, an outside force. Mm-hmm. But prior to 9/11, actually about a month before, I have two siblings who work in New York, and my sister would be walking on Park Avenue, and I'd speak with her, and she said, Frank, I have to move because I'm concerned that there's a crowd of people congregating here, and I've got to call you back later.
Has she moved?
After 9/11, she moved out of New York completely. My brother works on Park Avenue, too, and his employer suggested moving to a fashionable, high-profile building, you know, for their hedge fund business. Mm-hmm. And my brother from Boston and a coworker from San Francisco said that they believe that that would be extremely dangerous. Why would you want to do that?
But you're not buying the high-security state if it's a trade-off for all the liberties. Frank, we're almost out of time. Matthew Brzezinski, how deep into this conversation do you think the country is at this point? Are we still skirting around the edge? Are we beginning to come to grips with this? Where are we in the process?
We're scratching the surface. This is something that we won't even know how far and how deep we're heading until, as your callers and as David put it, until and everything depends on Al Qaeda, on Osama bin Laden, on terrorism. If the terrorists are successful, if there are more strikes, you know, with every strike, we're going to have to ramp up security, tighten security. If there are no strikes, then there won't be the need. And then maybe this conversation we're having is a tad premature. So, you know, everything time will only tell, and we'll see if the measures that are implemented to date suffice.
Some terrible tensions here. Matthew Brzezinski, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Matthew Brzezinski is contributing editor at the New York Times Magazine. He's author of Sunday's piece, The Homeland Security State, How Far Should We Go? You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org. This is On Point. Next month, two of America's oldest women's magazines, Women's Day and Ladies' Home Journal, are getting a makeover. The March issues will sport a fresh look that publishers hope will attract a new generation of readers and advertisers to two magazines that have never been known for being hip. New York writer Jean Rayla has never been a fan of what she has called frivolous women's magazines, but she's recently begun to reconsider.
When I was growing up, my mother only subscribed to two magazines, Ms. and Architectural Digest. While never explicitly stated, the message was clear. Women's magazines are frivolous. Although she was a stay-at-home mom and Girl Scout leader for my three older siblings, by the time I came along, my mother had found feminism and had gone back to school. She no longer knit or sewed. She read Marx and restricted my television viewing. She still took the time to cook for whoever was home. There was hot oatmeal for breakfast and natural peanut butter on whole wheat toast and carrot sticks for lunch. I didn't really mind that she locked herself in her office to study on the weekends or that I had to go to my grandparents after school. I was happy she was pursuing her dreams, although I did long for a ding-dong or a bowl of Frosted Flakes now and then. So I was kind of shocked when I spotted a copy of Ladies' Home Journal on my sister's coffee table. Could we both be our mother's daughters? I mean, I can happily devote an afternoon indulging in the latest edition of O, Martha Stewart Living, or Real Simple. I have defended these new breed magazines as important artifacts of women's culture. These new glossies tell women you can be interested in the home, in fashion and makeup, and still be worldly, educated, and intelligent, provided you buy the right products, of course. But Ladies' Home Journal? At first glance, articles on keeping your husband happy and 10 signs that he'll propose offended my girl power sensibilities. Thinning your thighs and gossip about J-Lo's love life, that didn't seem very enlightened. The thing is, I really admire my sister. She is a nurse, a mother of two, and perhaps one of the most generous women I know. Her children are incredibly well cared for, and she has given parenthood her undivided attention. Maybe my feminist offense to Ladies' Home Journal was pure snobbery. Maybe because I live in a big city, I'm out of touch with most women's lives, even my own sister's. The last winter, while staying with her, I actually sat down and read all of her copies of Ladies' Home Journal. Surprisingly, they weren't that bad. Having recently gotten married and with a baby on the way, I found myself appreciating the simple candor of the writing and attention to life's little details that often go unspoken. More importantly, by reading a women's magazine not marketed towards myself, I was reminded of what all women's magazines offer. Assurance that if we work harder, make our family candied ginger cookies, or wear the right dress, if we serve the right pâté to our dinner guests or cereal to our kids, that if we buy the right stuff, things will be okay. The doomed economy will pass us by. The impending war with Iraq won't touch us. Our children won't become drug addicts or convicts, and our husbands won't lose interest. Looking at my sister in her big suburban kitchen, behind her Costco-sized containers of cereal, I suddenly felt very close to her. Like a lot of women, we struggle with the sinking suspicion that we can't control everything, that danger lurks and risk is unavoidable, that bad things happen to good people. So while I inhabit a small apartment in Lower Manhattan, take the subway to work and read Real Simple, my sister lives in a big house in California, drives an SUV, attends football games, and reads Ladies' Home Journal. Ultimately, we are both searching for the same thing, safety against the unknown.
Jean Rayla is a writer living in New York City. Her latest book, Get Crafty, is due out next year. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded.